6. The people who have been through a lot are often the ones who are wiser and kinder and happier overall. This is because they've been through it, not past it or over it. They've completely acknowledged their feelings, and they've learned, and they've grown. They develop compassion and self-awareness. They are more conscious of who they let into their lives. They take a more active role in creating their lives, in being grateful for what they have, and in finding reasons for what they don't. 7. It showed you what you do deserve. Those relationships didn't actually hurt you. They showed you an unhealed part of yourself, a part that was preventing you from being truly loved. That's what happens when we finally get past hurtful experiences and terrible relationships. We realize we are worth more, and so we choose more. We realize how we blindly or naively said yes to someone or gave them our mind and heart space when we didn't have to. We realize our role in choosing what we want in our lives, and by experiencing what seems like the worst, we finally acknowledge that it feels so wrong because we deserve so much more. 8. Truly coming to peace with anything is being able to say, "Thank you for that experience." To fully move on from anything, you must be able to recognize what purpose it served and how it made you better. Until that moment, you'll only be ruminating over how it made things worse, which means you're not to the other side yet. To fully accept your life, the highs, lows, good, bad, is to be grateful for all of it, and to know that the good teaches you well, but the bad teaches you better. 37. Trying to make sense of your life is what's actually holding you back. You should try to make sense of your feelings. You should trace the lines of your thinking, find the genesis of your innermost beliefs, and make sure they're really yours. You should make lists of the things you do and don't value. You should ask yourself what you most feel you are lacking, and then look at how little you're giving them. But you should stop trying to make sense of your life. Doing so is trying to make sense of the trajectory, as though it's something that controls you, not the opposite way around. Doing so is applying the life you have to the person you were. Using logic and being mindful are not the same thing as trying to make sense. The former is methodical. It uses a grounded awareness to enact your true desires, while the latter is looking at the product of those actions and wondering how they got that way. There are questions to which answers may not exist. There are answers that just create more questions, solutions that can only be made from having lived something out, seen it through, tried. The best things will not make sense, not initially at least. Love is not logical. Grace and joy and beauty rarely are either. That doesn't mean you cannot use logic to work with them. Just that to fully see them, you need to use a different point of understanding. All things in their purest state are confusingly, singularly standing. They are magical because they are mysterious. They have unknown origins and palpable endings, and there is nothing to do but to live them and to see. People who waste their lives search for reasons to love rather than ways to love. They try to create avenues through which they can justify their happiness, rather than just letting themselves feel it for anything. They try to wield misguided logic to hold back from their happiness, rather than facilitate it. There will be things you understand immediately, effects for which the causes are entirely, consciously yours. There will be things that happen in your life that you know you've chosen, and then others that seem to be the opposite of what you'd want. Those things are just as important, if not more so. There are things that have reasons that will reveal themselves to you immediately. There are things that you won't understand for years and years to come. There are things you'll look back on and say, I never understood why that was. And yet, that will not make it any less so. Sometimes the point is to experience not knowing and confusion. What is born of your uncertainty is sometimes more important than not having been certain in the first place. You may never know whether or not you're meant to be in the city you live in, but you will live there anyway, because you have chosen it. You won't know whether or not you're meant to be with someone until you try. You will keep seeking comfort in the things that hurt you because you've yet to step into the discomfort of something new, something better, something unknown and foreign, and not aligned with what you once thought you wanted. That does not make it wrong or bad. It just means you didn't anticipate it. You didn't know well enough to have chosen it. Trying to make sense of your life is trying to see if the old story checks out, if the person you once were would be happy with the life they lead today. You're looking for answers in people that don't exist. Clarity comes from doing, not thinking about doing. A good life comes from choosing to work with what you have, accepting that you don't always choose what you work with, but knowing you're always given what you need to use, especially when you don't realize you need to use it. 38. How to detox your mind without having to go completely off the grid. Though we have miles to go in terms of learning what it means to take care of our bodies, we're even further behind on how to take care of our minds. Our brains construct our experiences, and there are so many factors that alter and shift our perspectives that are completely in our control, but totally out of our awareness. Here, a few things you can do to detox your mind, deprogram, and wipe the slate clean now and again. 1. Travel to assimilate to culture. Alter your base point concept of normal. What it will show you is how many behaviors, values, beliefs you've unconsciously adopted from your surroundings and ways you can change them. 2. Create physical solutions for emotional problems. People default on the idea that one emotion will cancel out or fix another. If you're upset, seek a high to eliminate it. But negative emotions are just calls to action that are being ignored through a little mental gymnastics and a lot of justification. Detoxing your mind is letting go of emotional highs in place of creating actual solutions. 3. Know that emotional toxicity is born of mental resistance. Instead of trying to create a certain emotional experience for yourself, if I do this and this, I will feel this way, try to practice complete acceptance of whatever you feel in the moment. Mental resistance keeps you in your emotional discomfort, even if it numbs it for a minute. 4. Identify your tethers. The problems that are in front of you are actually behind you. They are cracks in your foundation that are holding you back. Stop trying to dismantle symptoms. Go back and identify the causes. 5. Go for a long drive and let yourself get lost. Drive through neighborhoods you would never have known existed. See how other people live. See them come home from work and what their living rooms look like from the outside. It will comfort you in that you'll realize how small you are in a more practical way than just staring at the ocean. You don't know what you don't know. 6. Rearrange your furniture. Your brain constructs your experience through props and signals that those props fire off. You are continually subconsciously triggering negative or stagnant associations because of how your brain processes your surroundings. Change them. Change how you think. Change what you feel. 7. Do a mental purge. Just write down whatever weird thoughts continually cross your mind, or the little incoherent bits that are clogging your head. Just getting them out will give you relief. 8. Restructure your digital life. It's not realistic or desirable to a lot of people to be forever disconnected, But it's also not realistic to keep things that don't serve you positively in your social feeds and expect it not to affect you. Instead of just unfollowing what you don't want to see, follow positive accounts, groups, organizations, publications that you do. 9. Notice your unconscious movements. Notice your feet walking, and how you are not deciding to lift each one up and forward, and yet because your mind said, "Okay, self, let's get to this point today," you began to go. Consider your morning intentions similarly. 10. Cleanse your space emotionally. Consider the emotional attachment you have to the things you keep around you. Did you buy those clothes to be someone you're not? Do you have decor around your apartment that you got during a particularly crappy time in your life? Let those things go, but decide what to let go by thinking about what they make you feel. 11. Place yourself. Make a chart with 3 columns, and on the left, write everything you feel you've accomplished in your life, and in the middle, write down what your daily life entails, and then on the right, put what those consistent habits will lead to, / what you hope to do in the future. It helps you focus on the big picture. Getting lost in minutiae usually causes people anxiety. 12. Shift your physical position every time you start falling back into toxic thought cycles. This basically creates a new experience for your body and refocuses you in the moment, and it's simple enough to do at your desk at work. 13. Stretch your brain. Pick up a book on something that interests you and learn more about it. Look at research on something you have a theory about. Learn to love learning through actively engaging with things that naturally interest you. If nothing else, it will make you a bit more aware of the world. 14. Re-evaluate the extent of your connected disconnectedness. If the bulk of your relationships happen digitally, that aren't long distance, and you haven't had a conversation in person without being interrupted by a phone in a long enough time, evaluate how much you're prioritizing people in your life and realize that screens, not people, is basically the best way to create an extremely anxious lifestyle for yourself. 15. Identify what your addictions are keeping you distracted from. Most things people struggle with are addictions in some form, a thing you keep doing though you don't really want to. Understand that addiction is a disconnection from yourself, and a disconnection from yourself is born of something present that you think you can't face. 16. Learn to let good enough not be the opposite of perfect. If there is one thing that will give you the most mental, emotional relief, it is in letting good enough be good enough. 17. Dismantle the parts of your life that are solely performative. The thing is that most of what clogs our minds is all the unnecessary effort we put into constructing a life that seems a little more palatable, a little more noble, a little better than someone else's, so therefore good enough. But it accomplishes the opposite of what we intend. We place ourselves further from a genuinely happy experience, which is in accepting that life is small and simple, and more than enough, through grandiose ideas and attachments that end up making us into characters, not people. 18. Write down what you hate about other people. This is what you need to change about yourself, / your life, but are resisting too much to actually do something about. Know that it's often not a surface-level issue. You don't hate your annoying neighbor because she always bothers you for lunch, and you secretly bother other people for lunch. You hate her because she acts as though she's desperate for love, and you feel that way too but avoid it because you think it's embarrassing. This is a cheat sheet to seeing what's actually wrong in your life. It's important because completely understanding the problem is the same thing as knowing the solution. If you don't know what to do, you don't know what's wrong. If you don't know what's wrong, it's because some part of you is resisting seeing it. 39. 12 signs the only problem with your life is that you think about it more than you live it. Anxiety is usually bred out of inaction. We were born to actualize our potential, not just analyze it. Binge thinking is what happens when introspection becomes a means of avoiding a problem. Critically evaluating your life is supposed to facilitate living it, not the other way around. Hear all the things that happen when you let your life exist more in your brain than in reality. 1. Your goals are perfect outcomes, not perfect actions. You're more in love with ideas than you are with work and processes required to make them reality. When you dream up your perfect life, you think about how you're seen, rather than what your daily tasks include. 2. You're a maladaptive daydreamer. Maladaptive daydreaming is when you imagine extensive fantasies to replace human interaction or general function. Many people experience it while listening to music or doing some kind of rocking motion, walking, pacing, swinging, etc. Rather than cope with issues in life, you just daydream about grandiose alternatives that give you a high to eliminate the uncomfortable feeling. 3. Your purpose in life is abstract. You know that you want to help people, or teach, or give a voice to the voiceless, but you don't know how to do it, and you certainly don't focus on embodying it in your present life, in the situations you're already in, with people you come across in day-to-day interactions. 4. The solution to most of your problems would just be to make some small change, but you absolutely refuse to. This is a classic sign that you're using overthinking as a means of deflection. It's easy to do, as picking apart a problem is a noble-seeming distraction, but it's only useful until you have the answer. Then you actually have to act on it. 5. You're always busy, yet never productive enough. Your work never seems to be done. You lose hours and don't know where they've gone. You're always stressed and frizzling out your brain, as though you're perpetually in the middle of a high-intensity task that never sees completion. 6. You tend to resist what you want the most. Rather than putting forth genuine effort, opening up to it bit by bit, you've convinced yourself that you're not worth it, or that it's impossible, or that to have what you want means you could also lose what you want, so better not to have it ever than have it for a little bit. 7. You're one of those people who only bonds over what you hate. All this really means is that you, A, aren't doing enough to have something else, / more interesting to talk about, or B, are so deeply insecure you thrive off of recognizing that someone else is on your level. Judgment equals a need to be superior, which equals feeling incredibly inferior. 8. Most of your problems come back down to a fear of judgment or exclusion. If this fear is present in your life to any significant degree, it's usually because you've already constructed a lot of what you think you like or do based on what other people think. It's for this reason that you don't naturally take action. You think about it, change what you want to do in some way, and then maybe act, still fearful, that people will not like the facade either. 9. If you stopped and thought about it, you could come up with 10 things you're grateful for. Your problems aren't so much not having, as they are not recognizing what you do have. Gratitude incites more doing, more reciprocation. Positive feelings never leave you stagnating and overthinking them. 10. You want to change something about your life, but your focus is on dismantling the old rather than building something new that renders it obsolete. In other words, you're one of those people who tries to find comfort in overanalyzing old things to make more sense of them, when in reality, complexity is a product of insecurity, and insecurity a product of being unable to accept the simple reality of the situation. 11. You look for quick solutions more than you focus on restructuring the questions. When you try and fail at something, you spend too long focusing on why you failed, rather than learning what you need to, then moving on and trying something new. you keep yourself stuck between knowing what's not right and not being willing to figure out what might be. 12. You're always imagining what you want to do, yet never really doing it. You've convinced yourself that life begins when all the pieces are in place, but in reality, life is the act of doing just that. 40. Why logical people lead better lives, in a generation where passion is at a premium. Our generation believes that passion is the answer, the solution to a life joyously, successfully, happily lived. We were the kids who were told, you can be anything, and heard, you can succeed at everything. There are a lot of people much smarter than me who have argued this beautifully. It's not about following passion. It's about following purpose passionately. Passion is a manner of traveling, not a means to determine a destination. Passion is the spark that lights the fire. Purpose is the kindling that keeps it burning all night. I've said this before. This is to say, the opposite of passion isn't settling for a lukewarm life. It's marrying it to logic that will actually get you where you want to go. The ability to objectively look at our lives and interpret emotions and events and decisions with a grounded frame of mind is not only positive, it's essential to functioning. The head and heart must be separate entities that you figure out how to merge together. Here's why. 1. Passion tells you that you should go after what you most want in life. But it's never about what you want. It's about what you want most. It's about which of your, often conflicting, desires you let win. The only reason people don't do what they claim to want most is because there is something else they want a little bit more. They ultimately don't get what they want done because they're trying to follow their most intense desire, rather than prioritizing them. I'd like to have another day off, but I'd also like to work on my retirement fund and build my business some more. Right now, I'm choosing the latter so it can facilitate the former later on down the road. See that? Choosing which desire I let win. When people try to build their lives solely on emotions, they're incapable of choosing which desire they're going to follow. So they choose the one that elicits the most extreme high, which is fallible because it's impermanent, and it can come at the cost of innumerable consequences that are ultimately counterproductive to what they had intended in the first place. 2. Passion bases relationships on the high. Logic bases relationships on the purpose. The purpose being love, not attachment or not wanting to be alone or money or ego, as some people unfortunately do. We're usually taught that love is just a good feeling or a verb. But there are a lot of good feelings you can have that are not rooted in love, and things you can do out of what you perceive to be love when you're with someone important to you. It's the commitment to ground your relationship in something more than just a transitory feeling that will ultimately make it work. When you believe that passion is love, no more, no less, you'll want to end a relationship as soon as you're not getting that hormonal high from your partner. Or worse, you'll blame them for it and seek out what they're lacking and why. The way this usually manifests is in people being very indecisive and uncertain about whether or not they love someone, whether or not they should let go or try harder or wait it out or accept that love isn't always a fever dream. I have personally spent years trying to figure out whether or not I really loved different people, and about half that time flip-flopping in and out of relationships, only to eventually figure out that I confused passion for love, and they aren't the same thing. 3. Logic allows you to see objectively. Passion is subjective and consuming. The thing about the things people are most passionate about is that it's a scream that takes all their might and echoes out into the void. There's no practice or reason. It's just a flush of emotion, and when it collides or contradicts someone else's, it can feel like a personal affront. No matter how fierce your feeling or belief, it exists next to a variety of other things, not all of which will overlap or align. This does not mean you or anybody else is wrong. Just that passion does not allow you to acknowledge coexisting truths. It is singular, and it is destructive when it can't be placed in reality. 4. Logic helps you make decisions for the person you hope to be. Passion helps you make decisions for the person you are or were. What makes a sense of passion so intense is that, essentially, it answers a question you didn't know you were asking. It is a solution to something you've struggled with all along. It is something that proves a point you didn't know you had to make. It is self-evident to you. It is some kind of liberation or transcendence. Something about it gives you a high, which means that it's familiar, and it's serving as an antidote. The one true sign that you're moving ahead with your life is that you don't know where you're going. If you knew what you were doing, you'd be circling the same path again. The one true sign that you're living in the past is if you feel that reckless high. You're proving something to someone or to yourself. 5. The passion narrative says you should strive for a life that maxes out your wildest dreams. The logic narrative says you should strive for a life that maxes out your potential. The passion narrative, therefore, keeps you in a place of assuming your life is less than, because you're not doing what you think is ideal. The logic narrative, however, tells you to evaluate why you want those things, and eventually brings you to the conclusion that most of the time, you don't. Rather than maxing out your dreams, logic tells you to max out your potential, which ultimately gets you to the same place that passion could only have you keep dreaming of. 6. Passion is born of attachment. Logic counteracts it. Passion is an attachment to an idea, or more often, a particular feeling. It is the desire to keep experiencing that one feeling and to do what it takes to facilitate that feeling, no matter what. When people imagine a passionate life, they imagine doing things and being with people that make them feel a specific way. Not only is that unrealistic, it's ultimately impossible. Logic tells you that even at a job you adore, there will be hard days. Being in a relationship with the love of your life doesn't necessarily make it easy, though that's what people assume and yearn for. When you go in with the, I will do what it takes, even when it's hard attitude, you end up building the foundations, skills, and abilities to cope so well that after a period of time, the initial difficulty, ironically, dissolves. 7. Gratitude is born of logic. A happy life is born of gratitude. The reason people practice gratitude, or make a commitment to reflect on what they're grateful for, is that, unfortunately, few people naturally sense it in their lives. And no matter what your current situation, anybody can find a reason to. Cultivating a sense of gratitude, which is not waiting for a feeling of being happy with your life, but choosing it by actively focusing on what you're fortunate, grateful, and proud to have, is essential to ever feeling satisfied with your life, because it puts you in a mindset to seek more to be grateful for. As anybody can tell you, what you seek, you ultimately find. 8. Logic dismantles emotion. Passion tries to use emotion to dismantle other emotions. Logic can dismantle irrational, illogical, or painful emotions and bring you to a higher state of awareness by evaluating their roots slash determining their causes, deciphering whether or not they are useful, or by actually listening to them and acting accordingly, if that's what's best. Passion tries to use emotions to dismantle others. A high to negate a low. A new feeling to replace an old one. It's like trying to grab at water with your hands, thinking you'll ever get enough to drink. It is a strong, clear, guided mind that undoes the irrational stress of what Buddhists call the monkey mind. The irrational, unprompted series of thoughts that cross everyone's mind each day, which ultimately affect, if not construct, your emotional state. Logic can tell you how the mind and heart correspond. Passion thinks they're one in the same. 9. A lot of people who want to pursue passion and find passionate relationships are seeking out of a place of lack. Things that are soulful, genuine, and loving are rarely, if ever, hysterical or highly emotional. They're peaceful and desirable and beautiful and sometimes powerful. But the manic desire to do anything is usually an attempt to fill a hole, run from a problem, avoid a truth. The obsessive desire for a passionate relationship is usually a reflection of a lack of love for oneself. The manic need to pursue a passionate career is rooted in an intense unhappiness with present reality. They are a series of soothing thoughts and deflection methods and escape routes. The monster everyone's running from, of course, is themselves. 10. Nobody ever got anything from wanting it badly enough. I really don't care how passionate you claim to be about something. It doesn't mean you're right for the job, or the relationship, or the promotion, or apartment, or whatever the case may be. But people tend to claim being passionate as a qualifying factor when, at the end of the day, the person who gets the job is the one who is most technically capable. Both parties need to be convinced the relationship is the right one for it to ever be. The promotion will go to the person who worked the hardest, and the apartment to the person with the best credit score. Often people focus and communicate how badly they want something to suffice for the actual reasons that they aren't right, slash qualified, slash good enough to get it. 11. It's doing, not thinking about doing, that creates a life well lived. If you want your life to be different, do differently. A lot of our concept of what makes for a happy existence is rooted in the abstract. Think clearly. Have a positive frame of reference. Be surrounded by people you care about. Have a sense of purpose in your work. But these things don't work unless they are genuine, and too many people try to fake it as though they can even convince themselves it's real. The alternative is doing the work. It's the nitty-gritty, ass-on-the-ground, nose-to-the-grindstone hard work that people avoid because they don't want to be responsible for their own failures. Can't fail if you haven't tried, eh? Confidence is built from what you do. A positive mindset is rooted in what you do. Loving relationships are sustained from what you do. Purposeful work is cultivated by doing it, not thinking about why you should, and believing that's the same thing. 12. Passion is the easy way out. Take $150K in loans to study something you love for 5+ years, but not be able to move out, travel, get married, have kids, work a job you actually like because you're drowning in debt for the next 30. That's what passion does. Marry the person you're consumed by, whose neglect and abuse fuels you in its recreation of your childhood issues. Be so torn apart when they leave you that you convince yourself that they're the only one for you. How could you ever be so broken over anything but true love? Base your relationship on how far from reality you stretch when you're together. Lose friends and work and a sense of self. That's what passion does. Or rather, that's what passion does when it's not married to logic. That's what unbridled feelings will do when they aren't stopped by thought and understanding. That's what happens when you believe your emotions rather than questioning their origins. It's what happens when you try to avoid the inevitable suffering of the human condition with a surge of emotion that you think will be the antidote. Passion is the easy way, the cut corner, the half-assed route to the life you want to live. As with all things passion is born of, it can only sustain an idea, not a reality. 41. Things you need to know about yourself before you'll have the life you want. As C.J. Jung once said, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life, and you will call it fate. when it comes to building the lives we want to lead, we're taught to start constructing from how we imagine we want things to look. Titles rather than roles. Images rather than realities. Concepts rather than day-in and day-out tasks and duties and practices. It's time to dismantle the ego-frenzied Western obsession with a big life and break down what it takes to actually exist in a way we desire. Here, all the things you must know about yourself so you can choose the life you actually want, not the one you think you do. What do you want your daily tasks to be? We're instructed to choose the life we want based on what we think we want to be, but we're only capable of determining that insofar as we are able to think of what it would mean to have the title of a role. We rarely consider the nitty-gritty daily practice that is required for a peaceful, meaningful existence. Instead of, "I want to help people each day," start asking yourself if the way you really want to do that is by caring for people physically, doing the tasks that actually requires. It all sounds flowery and noble when you think of what you want your life to be about, but you must consider the reality. When you go in choosing what you want each day of your life to consist of, how much paperwork, how much time at the computer, how many hours of leisure, you're able to actually build the existence you want from the ground up. What kind of person do you want to be? As opposed to, what titles do you want to have? It's not about choosing what kind of adjective you'd like as a preface to your job title, but what kind of person you want to be doing it. It ultimately doesn't matter whether you're a teacher, or student, or editor, or construction worker. It matters what kind of person you want to be while you do those jobs. Are you someone who is kind and understanding? Who spends the better portion of their day conversing with loved ones? Someone who is busy from daybreak to day's end? Someone who is distracted, attentive, hardworking? You ultimately are defined not by what you do, but how you do it. What do you want to be remembered for? What do you want them to say at your funeral? That you wore a small pant size and had a successful job that prevented you from actually developing relationships? Or that you were loving and kind and cared about your work, but cared about people more? Your impermanence is a thing you should meditate on every day. There is nothing more sobering, nor scary, nor a faster way to cut the negative bullshit than to remember that you do not have forever. What defines your life when it's all said and done is how much you influence other people's lives, oftentimes just through your daily interactions and the courage with which you live your own. That's what people remember. That's what you'll be known for when you're no longer around to define yourself. What comes most effortlessly to you? We tend to believe and induce a kind of difficulty with tasks we determine to be meaningful or profound or important. If the things we love, and especially get paid for, are also effortless, it seems as though they are unmerited. We believe we have to suffer for the things we have and love when we, in fact, do not. It's just as worthwhile, if not maybe more so, to figure out what you effortlessly, naturally do, and learn to capitalize on it while not feigning effortlessness, but just allowing it. What do you even unconsciously believe that your existence is about? Is it random? The act of a higher power? It doesn't matter who is right or wrong or totally nuts. We may never know for sure. But it is about developing a personal dogma that serves you. This is the singular most telling belief about a person, because it essentially defines how you approach everything else. If you believe that your fate is yours to choose, you will. If you don't, you'll stay victimized, self-pitying, waiting and begging on your knees until some external circumstance shifts and it's deemed the random work of a higher power. If that's how you want to exist, that's your prerogative. But I find that most people don't. Most people want to reclaim their power and choose for themselves. But that liberation begins with one question. What do you think you're here for? What's the point of it all? Explore what you most inherently believe, and then determine how you can live that out to the best of your ability. Why do you do what you do each day? Is it to feel a high? For money? For livelihood? There's no right or wrong answer here. The point is simply just to know what most strongly motivates you. Even if it's just making a living, you can fuel a passion project with the desire to more comfortably pay bills each month. Longer-term goals and simple survivalist needs are often the most grounding and constant desires to base yourself in. They should be balanced out with meaningful work and a sense of purpose. But if they are ultimately why you do what you do, don't fight it for some morally superior alternative. Use it to fuel something emotionally, mentally, spiritually positive. In your fantasy daydreams, who and what are you, and how do other people regard you? The recurring thematics of your daily daydreaming represent what you're actually seeking from others in various areas of your life. This is your subconsciously motivating factor, because it's the thing you have yet to give yourself. Whatever it is, it's a projection of the thing you most feel you lack, and therefore, subconsciously seek from others. Is it that people admire you for your beauty, your creativity, your talent, your success, your money? Figure out what you crave, and figure out how to feed that need yourself. What do you dislike most about other people? What you most dislike in others is, in some variation, true of you. You just haven't been able to acknowledge it yet. The more angrily and fiercely you respond no to that idea, the more intensely you are trying to avoid it. Anger equals recognition. You don't lash back at things you don't, in some way, regard as being real. So figure out what you most need to heal within yourself by seeing what you most want to change in others. Doing so will free you in a way you can't imagine. Doing so is a necessary piece of the life you want puzzle, because all the energy you're using trying to avoid, deflect, delude your way into not acknowledging what you need to heal, change, deal, is being wasted at best, and is actually actively keeping you from the life you want at worst. What is worth suffering for? Everything is hard in some way. It's hard to be in the wrong relationship. It's hard to be in the right one. It's hard to be broke and miserable. It's hard to achieve your dreams. It's hard to be stuck in the middle, not really feeling anything at all. Everything is hard. But you choose your hard. You choose what's worth it. You don't choose whether or not you'll suffer, but you do choose what you want to suffer for. What owns you in this life? Is it your desire for happiness? The past? The relationship that almost was but ultimately didn't? Your body hang-up? Your fear? Your loneliness? Your lack of self-worth? Everybody has one thing that ultimately owns them, drives them, controls them at some visceral level. It's the pattern that everything else is rooted in. It's the issue that crops up again and again. It's what you insatiably seek, then run away from, only to find you ran right into it. What owns you in this life makes up the majority of what you do, so you need to know what it is. It's usually not about freeing yourself from these ties that bind you, but learning to wield them for a greater purpose. Finding the shard of empathy and hope and understanding tucked deeply within your existential suffering. There is a purpose to all things. Your job is not to understand why, but just to find it in the first place. 42. Things emotionally healthy people know how to do. Of all the health concerns our culture claims to be concerned about, it is perhaps our emotional health that is most severely neglected. It's not the same thing as mental health. We're comfortable talking about our recurring headaches, as we don't feel their presence makes a statement about us. They're disassociated from who we believe ourselves to be. But we know our emotions are a result of who and how we are, and in a desperate plight to preserve the sanctity of our self-idea, we hide. Ironically, that's where the trouble comes in. It's the part of us we suppress and ignore that are the parts that become silent, insidious, controlling monsters. It's referred to in psychology as shadow selves. Talking about how one gets from there to here at the place of emotional health is another topic altogether, and would require books worth of writing to fully flesh out. So in the meantime, I gathered the 10 elements of an emotionally healthy person. This hypothetical hybrid of positivity probably doesn't exist, but these are nonetheless worth considering and maybe striving for. 1. Emotionally healthy people know how to listen to their pain. Emotional stress and discomfort is a signal that there's a better way, that something's misaligned. It's always directing us towards something better, more aligned with who we are and want to be. The only challenge is getting past whatever made us ignore it in the first place. 2. They know how to observe thoughts objectively and not identify with them. You are not your thoughts. You are not your feelings. You are the being that observes, reacts, uses, generates, and experiences those things. This is to say, you can't control them, but they don't control you. You choose what you think about. You choose what you allow to pass. And when you can't allow yourself to let things go, you're trying to tell or show yourself something. Pay attention. 3. They can see within them the things they dislike in others. One more time for the people in the back. You love in others what you love in yourself. You hate in others what you cannot see in yourself. When you practice self-identifying every time you find yourself frustrated or inexplicably annoyed with someone or their behavior, you tap into an ultimate tool for growth and the fastest route to creating a more peaceful existence for yourself. You're no longer at the whim of other people's behaviors, because ultimately, you were never angered by them. It always existed in you. 4. They're able to differentiate loving something versus loving the idea of it. To be conscious of why they desire something, not just that they desire it. Ideas solve problems we make up in our heads. If we believe that we're unworthy of love, we need the idea of a loving, doting partner who affirms how perfect we are to correct it. Without understanding that we want that love to fix something in us, we just think we desperately want love because we're romantic or because happy lives do not exist without it. But the people who are conscious of why they desire something are able to choose wants that are not based in solving a problem, but in something more genuine and healthy. 5. They know when it's time to break up with a friend. It's often difficult to determine the line between being committed to a relationship even when it isn't sunshine and happiness and knowing when it's time to step away from something that's no longer a positive force in your life. Often we feel almost guilted into remaining close with people to whom we don't actually feel obligation, and that is a recipe for emotional disaster. Emotionally healthy people can identify the people who are spiteful, jealous, or too wrapped in their own issues to not project them onto everybody else. Do these people need love and companionship too? Certainly. But sometimes walking away is the best way to do that. Most of the time, it's the healthiest choice. 6. They live minimally, but realistically. Emotionally healthy people know that no physical acquisition can shock them into feeling what they desire, not for more than a moment anyway. So they forego the rat race and learn to be grounded in the simplicity of life. They want not and waste not, keep in their space only things that are meaningful or useful. They are mindful and intentional, grateful and wise with what they consume and keep. 7. They can be alone. What you find in solitude is perspective. When you're not in the presence of people with whom you must monitor your reactions and choose your sentences wisely, you can let yourself just be. It's why we find it most profoundly relaxing and why emotionally healthy people practice it often. When there's nobody else around for whom you must tailor your emotions, you can experience them fully. 8. They let themselves feel. The core of every emotional issue is the belief that it's not okay. It's not the presence of it that's harmful. It's the resistance to it that ultimately screws us up. Emotionally healthy people know how to do one thing profoundly better than anybody else. Let themselves feel anything and everything they're going through. They know it won't kill them. They know to set aside time to process. They know that contrary to common belief, doing so is not a loss of control, but rather the route to being grounded and resolved enough to actually be fully present and centered, which is as in control as a human can be. 9. They do not attach to any one outcome being good or right. The moment you decide one outcome is the right outcome, you are also deciding that another outcome is the wrong one. Beyond this, some things work out the way we intend for them to, others don't. This is a gift, too. 10. They see the value and purpose of each and every experience. The point of anything is not what you get from having done it. It's who you become from having gone through it. It's all about growth at the end of the day. The bad things grow you, and the good things do too. And in reality, bad is only what you're taught or come to believe isn't right. The point is, it's not about how much you get right. It's how much you get better. And every experience, the good, bad, terrible, wonderful, confusing, messy, great, does just that. In the words of Johanna de Salento, the only way to fail is to abstain. 43. How to measure a good life. We measure a good life based on how well we adhere to trajectories, how closely what happens is aligned with our temporary subjective past thoughts about it. The measure of a life well lived is a cultural, social concept, and it's changed over time. The governing belief of what will make for a worthwhile existence right now for us is individual accomplishment. At other times in history, it was religious obedience or procreation and so on. We're not made to be self-serving in an existential way. In fact, we classify doing so as all but a mental disorder. Everything, even our most rote daily tasks, only seem comfortable if they add up to something in the end. But we set out to maximize our pleasure regardless. To aggrandize individuality in lieu of community and wholeness. And in the process, we find that instead of our passions compounding into a spectacular life, we're empty and stressed and exhausted and twisted in mental circles trying to make sense of why things don't feel the way they appear. Nothing looks the way we think it will. Nobody reflects on their lives and concludes with, "Yes, this is exactly how I thought it would go." The point is not to get reality to align with ideas about it, or to manipulate those ideas about the uncontrollable so we feel in power of them. Yet the measuring stick for a good life does just that, as it's still rooted in our most basic operating system, our survivalist instincts, which want sex and pleasure and fame and recognition and ego-augmenting attention. It's the hit and go, get and chase, want and strive and ruthlessly steal. We're able to dress these things up to seem civilized when the people acting on them are in offices and grocery stores and our Tinder accounts. Animals don't actualize what it means to have gotten their prey or not. They don't consider the psychological implications of a potential mate walking away. They don't piece together their lives or reach for more. Their instinctive existence works because they don't inherently desire to transcend it. Animals have no need to evaluate whether or not they've had a good life, so they don't strive to be more than they are. But we do. Yet by measuring how much good we've done by images, ideas, and clean storylines, we sorely miss the point. We always fall short. We were not built to be more than we are. Our desire to be more isn't a matter of being beyond our humanness, but wanting to be comfortably in it. Sages teach that we're designed for the messiness and simplicity of everyday life, that desiring an external more is a mechanism of the ego. It's not transcendence, it's avoidance. The way to measure a good life is by how much you still want to change it, which is proportionate to how much you inherently know it can be better. You measure a good life by your capacity to feel discomfort, the extent to which you've questioned yourself, how many times you've changed your mind, the series of dogmas you've adopted and left, the family you chose for yourself. The number of coffee cups over which you've had funny and serious and hurtful and beautiful talks. The depth to which your empathy extends. The number of long walks you've taken by yourself and journal pages you've filled with the incoherent thoughts. The evolution of the way you philosophize your existence. The evolution of the way you perceive other people. The days you've soberly worked despite the shards of passion having dissolved. A good life isn't passionate. It's purposeful. Passion is the spark that lights the fire. Purpose is the kindling that keeps the flame burning all night. The number of relationships you've had the courage to end. The easy way out is to stay. The comforting idea is to settle. The liberation is how many times you reach for something more, even though you can't conceive of what that could be. That unnameable feeling is the mark of a good life. You measure a good life by the time you sincerely felt the sunlight across your bedsheets in the morning was awe-inspiringly divine. The ways you can count, you were a better person than before. The ways you can count, you'd like to be better in the future. The number of things that you lost and learned how to not attach to anymore. The number of moments in which you were almost at the end of your capacity, only to find that there was another ocean's worth once you were pushed beyond the surface. A good life is not measured by what you do. It's about what you are. Not how many people you loved, but how much. It has nothing to do with how well things turn out, or how seamlessly the plan is followed. It's about the bits of magic you stumble upon when you dive off path. It's not about the things that didn't work out. It's about what you learn when they don't. Those bits and pieces, awakenings and knowledge, are what build and make you able to perceive things greater than you can currently imagine. A good life is not how it adds up in the end, but what you're counting along the way. 44. There is a voice that doesn't use words. This is how you listen to it. The voice you have to listen to will rarely make sense. It won't use words. It won't use logic. It won't fit within the neat trajectory of the storyline that you imagined. It will be subtle, and it will speak to you without you ever knowing that it is. The feelings your inner voice gives you will be unjustifiable. you won't have reasons for them. You'll know you love someone not because they're attractive and smart and interesting, but just because you do. You'll want to live somewhere or do something not because it's cool or everybody says you should.